On This Week in Enterprise Tech, why is the NSA listening to your calls? How are they listening to your calls? And what can you do about it? Twiet on the Set.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twiet.
Bandwidth for This Week in Enterprise Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twiet, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 46, recorded June 17, 2013. NSA Deep Dive. This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by GoToMeeting with HD Faces by Citrix, the powerfully simple way to meet and collaborate with colleagues and clients from anywhere. You can share the same screen and see each other face-to-face with HD video conferencing, even from an iPad. Sign up for your 30-day free trial today. Visit GoToMeeting.com, click on the Try It Free button, and use the promo code ENTERPRISE. And by Hover.com. Hover is the reliable domain name registration and management service that's simple, honest, and easy to use. For exceptional customer support and 10% off your new domain name, go to hover.com/enterprise and enter offer code ENTERPRISE. And by TechServe. TechServe assists U.S. businesses of all sizes with their technology needs, including Apple, Avid, Adobe, and HP solutions. Visit techserve.com/twiet and receive a complimentary iPad deployment assessment. Welcome to Twiet, This Week in Enterprise Tech. It's the show dedicated to the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and the geek who just wants to know how the world is connected. I'm your host, Father Robert Balasair, the digital Jesuit, your guide to all things in the enterprise. And as always, I am joined by an all-geek, all-star, all-stellar cast, starting with my good friend, Mr. Brian Chi, the evangelist for Thin Links in Honolulu, Hawaii. Brian, how are you today? And, how's the weather?
Well, it's a little rainy and overcast, but you know what? I want to send out some love to whoever wrote the Windows 8 Twiet client. It's awesome, and I can watch the video and have the chat right at the bottom, and I can cut and paste to it. It's great. So shout out to the developers for that app.
We love developers. Now, we've also got joining us from, from somewhere. I'm not exactly sure where he is because he's always on the road. Mr. Curtis Franklin from Enterprise Efficiency. Curtis, thank you very much for coming back.
It is a pleasure to be here, Padre. Today I am in beautiful Boston, Massachusetts, up here getting ready for the E2 conference and sharing a hotel with much of the sporting press from the nation. They're in town for
some very important stuff to do with hockey. He'll be right back. Now, of course, our panel is filled by a man who really needs no introduction on this program. When we talk about the honestness, the truthfulness, when we talk about keeping us real, there's really only one man who we have to mention. That's Mr. Oliver Rist. Oliver, thank you very much for joining us. And where do you find yourself today?
Clinically depressed, but other than that, I'm still in the Northwest, the sunny Northwest. Now we have our 15 minutes of summer here, so I'm happy about that. And yes, I'm going to keep you honest and going to tease Brian a lot.
So the panel is set. That's who we're going to be having on the show. That's what we're going to be talking about, specifically about the NSA. Now I want to stop and put a disclaimer. Everyone, take a collective deep breath, hold it for a second, and let it out. There's been a lot of speculation about what this story is and isn't, what the NSA is and is not doing, what information is being gathered. We don't want to participate in the knee-jerk hysteria of that scandal. Instead, we really want to break it down. We want to give you a deep dive, geek-level, enterprise-level understanding of what's going on. So with that in mind, let's get to it. We know a little bit about the NSA scandal. We know how this is working. Let's do a quick explanation. There is the FISA court, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, which has been established to allow us to create secret orders, a secret court that can compel certain individuals, certain companies to do things in the interest of national security. Now, we're not here to debate the wiseness of having such an institution, but we know that the NSA spying scandal involves the FISA court. The FISA court allowed the government to collect and manage data from 9 different internet companies. We've got a story from Wired from their threat level that shows one of the slides that was released, giving us the timeline for this program known as PRISM. Now, we know that Microsoft came on board in September of 2007, which makes sense because back then they were the largest tech company, they were the largest software company, and they had really, really good web services, Hotmail. Right after them was Yahoo in March of 2008. Of course, that was back when Yahoo and Hotmail ruled the web services roost. Google was added in January of 2009, Facebook in June of 2009, PalTalk in December of 2009, YouTube in September of 2010, Skype in February of 2011. And it's important to note that this was before they were purchased by Microsoft in May of 2011. AOL came on March of 2011, and Apple at the end of 2012. These are the nine companies that together make up at least what we can confirm about the PRISM program, that it's collecting data from those nine entities. I want to go over to you, Oliver. You have a few opinions about this gathering of data on the corporate level. Does it make sense that these were the nine companies that were singled out by the FISA court for data gathering?
Well, let's just clear one thing up, and it's weird. I'm going to go backwards on it, but there was another article off ZDNet explaining that people got it wrong, right? These companies are not, quote, on board. These companies got targeted. However, while they're fighting it, they're losing a lot. So as the guy who has the data, I'm not sure that distinction really matters to me. Point is, my data is still getting spied on for the most part. However, it is good to know that on the corporate side, they're not taking it lying down. Then again, I don't think they have any choice because obviously if it turned out that Office 365 was giving away every single piece of data willy-nilly, their usage would plummet. So I think they have to.
Right.
What was your question?
I do want to say that is actually a perfect distinction to make at the beginning of this discussion. When we say on board, we mean that they basically had to surrender to the FISA court. I mean, they received an order. They did fight it. All of the stories say that at some point they fought it, although they couldn't publicize that they were fighting it. And ultimately, they lost. And so their data started being collected by the NSA. The question was, does it make sense that it's these nine companies? Why these nine that were targeted first?
Probably could be because they're the most popular. I do believe one of the quotes said, like, Dropbox coming soon, which was pretty ominous, right? So I think they're going to basically cycle through everyone. I think they picked these guys because aside from that PalTalk company, those are the most, you know, the largest, most well-known, right? I think that's probably means they have the largest customer segment, ergo they make, you know, it makes sense to jump them first.
Right. Cheever, let me go over to you because you and I have had a lot of experience with the actual hardware that allows this sort of data to be collected and to be sorted through. When you look at this list of nine companies, are there any notable exclusions or, you know, does the timeline make sense? That was Microsoft first, then Yahoo, Apple at the end.
You know, the list is pretty good. You know, I agree with Oliver's. You know, the NSA and so forth are probably going for low-hanging fruit. But I need to point out that the NSA is actually doing their job according to the mandate that when they were set up. They are supposed to monitor communications in support of the military and intelligence agencies of the United States of America. So they are actually doing their job and doing it correctly. The FISA court is where there is due diligence set up so that these corporations have a say in this, but as part of being part of the United States and the communications infrastructure, it is considered a strategic resource and thusly needs to be monitored because there are lots and lots of people that would like to do us harm.
Okay. Yeah. Curtis, let me go over to you. Again, trying to avoid the knee-jerk reaction, does it surprise you that these companies would be targeted or even that more than these nine companies would be targeted? This is where the data flows. This is where the data is stored. This is where the information is kept. Cheever's right, right? I mean, the NSA would rightfully go after these companies.
Well, I think when you ask the question, why these companies for data, it's like the question that was put to Willie Sutton about why he robbed banks. He said, that's where the money is. Look at these companies. That's where the data flow is. And so I think it does make sense. You look at pretty much any list of top referrer or top talker, you're going to see these companies. And that's where it makes sense. All of this is very logical. It has nothing to do with politics of the individual companies. It has to do with the profile of their users and the volume of the data. you know, where you get into, I heard an interesting thing actually this last Sunday. Former Vice President Dick Cheney was asked about the metadata that's being sniffed on a regular basis, and he pointed out that according to court decisions that have come down, that data doesn't belong to the individuals whose traffic instigated the metadata. That's considered to be a business record of the companies involved. So there is an extent to which NSA and its supporters would say, hey, in general, this isn't private information that's being sniffed at all. The only people who should be complaining, if anyone's going to complain, are the companies, because it's their business data that we're looking at.
Right, right. Now, I should mention that, and again, this is not confirmed, but aside from all the yelling and screaming about the NSA is listening to calls, is not listening to calls, is collecting this data, collecting that data, one of the possible scenarios is that the NSA was collecting data that would be stored in what one of our representatives called a lockbox for looking at later. So if, let's say they were collecting all the data about particular phone numbers, not actually screening through them until they found a reason to actually do it. This doesn't make it better. I'm not giving them a legal justification. I'm not saying that makes me feel any better about the spying program, but I think it gives a little bit of a clue into what the NSA was trying to do. Let me step a little bit back here. We're talking about these nine companies, but I do want to also mention that several of the stories talk about how thousands of companies actually participated with the government, not necessarily giving customer info, but giving specs, giving different strategic bugs. Like, for example, there's a report that Microsoft has been sharing zero-day bugs with the NSA, which, of course, the implication there for developers is if you've got a zero-day bug that nobody knows about, you now have the ability to run an exploit against computers running Windows. We have information about Intel sharing McAfee data. Intel owns McAfee, and also giving to the NSA exploits that could possibly be used in trying to crack into secure systems. We've also got stories about how AT&T, Verizon, Sprint Level 3, and CenturyLink all provided taps after being indemnified by the federal government against wiretapping laws. So it's not just the nine that were targeted. There are hundreds, maybe thousands of companies that participated in one way or another, either sharing data or sharing specs about their hardware and software that allowed this program to grow. Let me ask you this. I'm going to go with you, Oliver, first. If these companies are sharing information with the federal government, it stands to reason that they'd be getting something back, right? I mean, it's not just a patriotic move. You're not just going to say, well, of course, I'm going to give this to the government. Wouldn't there be some sort of expectation of tit for tat?
I don't see where you're getting that. They're being sued to do it. They're fighting it in court. So I'm not sure where the tit for tat is coming from.
Right. Well, I'm referring to specifically of there was a story, and again, non-confirmed, that Google received some confidential briefings on their servers being attacked by hackers in China. There was sort of an allusion drawn to this of saying, well, okay, Google, if you want access to confidential information, you're going to also have to play with us. Now, again, not saying that this is confirmed, not saying that this is exactly what happened, but it seems to me that there might be some incentive for companies to work with the federal government.
Well, that, yeah, I mean, that's security based. I mean, I guess the NSA, in that sense, taking Brian's tack, would be doing their job, and Google should be listening since they're protecting us. It sounds like the way you're phrasing it, though, is like they're getting some kind of benefit from it other than being briefed on, yes, Chinese hackers are trying to crack your servers, which I'm sure Google already knows. I guess the NSA might be giving them information on how they're trying to do that, which would be a good thing. One of the few good things I hear out of this.
Okay. Cheever, let me throw over to you. I understand you've had a little bit of experience with this area of expertise, I'll call it.
Actually, while I can't talk about the past experience, what I can talk about is every single corporation, in fact, even individuals in the United States can qualify for a certain level of access to confidential information if you are willing to go through a background check, and it is a light background check. you can join InfraGard, InfraGard. I think it's .gov or .org. Can't remember. You can get access to things. I actually get documents that are marked for government use only, but I obtain them legally through InfraGard. So I get to know about certain attacks that are coming down. In fact, when we were at Interop, I actually got a notice of a potential or probable attack that was going to happen within the next 12 hours. So it's most of the time very timely information, and it also gives you a path to cooperate with the FBI or the various government agencies, and well worth your time.
Yeah. All right. Let me back up a little bit again, because we're talking about the data being collected. There's questions in the chat room from people who are asking, well, what exactly is being done with this data? Who's going to be analyzing? What are you doing with the metadata, the data points that you're collecting? Curtis, let me throw over to you, because I understand that you're an expert in a particular framework, a particular software that might have a dance involved with it that is really good at interpreting big data. What is that tool again? And what could you foresee plugging metadata into that tool would give us?
Is it possible that you're referring to Hadoop, 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 Hadoop?
Absolutely, yes. What could this be used in Hadoop? How could this be used in Hadoop?
Well, the big thing that Hadoop allows is correlation. And that's really what we've been talking about since 9/11. How do conversations between certain telephone numbers or between certain nations tie in to credit card transactions, tie into searches for information? And if you had to put all of that together by hand, it's laborious and time-consuming. The whole concept of big data is that you can set algorithmic engines in place to churn through this information and look for correlations and patterns that say that when you tie certain patterns between certain endpoints together, it indicates that, well, bad guys might be at work. And that's what we're hearing from the government, that there have, in fact, been attacks that have been stymied because they've been able to put together these correlations. And that really is the question that everyone has to ask. Is it worth it if these things are effective? How much intrusion is an appropriate cost for a given level of effectiveness? And that's where we're going with this. I think that's where the discussion is ultimately going. Where is the intersecting line between the intrusion that we're willing to put up with and the protection against attack? And that intersection is a movable point. We get to decide where we want to fine-tune its location.
Oh, okay. I do want to move on a little bit, but before we do that, again, responding to some of the yelling that's going on in the chat room, because this is a passionate subject, I want to read the constitutional passage that is affecting everyone here. The rights of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrant shall issue, but upon probable cause, supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized. Now, this is constantly reiterated every time someone talks about the illegality of the NSA spying program. There is really only one thing that's up for debate, and that is what constitute unreasonable searches and seizures. We're going to get right back to that right after this break, where we'll be talking about the actual technology that allows us to tap digital conversations. But before then, I want to take a break and talk about the first supporter of the Twiat Rider and a Twiat Riot. And of course, that's Citrix and GoToMeeting. Now, summer is almost here. The weather is good. The kids are getting out of school. We're going on vacation. There are so many places that we would all rather be than in our office. But we know that if we want our businesses to run, if we want our work to continue, well, we have to stay productive. We have to meet with our colleagues, with our coworkers, with our customers. We have to stay connected. That's why we use GoToMeeting with HD Faces, the powerfully simple way to meet and collaborate online. Now, with GoToMeeting by Citrix, it takes just a click to share your screen and work on documents in real time. And you can just turn on your webcam to turn your meeting into an online HD video conference. You get to see each other face to face, which is like meeting in person. You can see a frown. You can see a smile. You can see if someone is actually getting it rather than if they're just telling you if they're getting it. You can launch or join a meeting from wherever you are. That's one of the things that makes GoToMeeting so great. Wherever you are, whenever you need to use your computer, you can use your smartphone, your tablet, even your iPad to log in and communicate. You may have noticed that I am particularly enthusiastic about GoToMeeting. Well, that's because I use it on a daily basis for my work and, yes, for my podcasting. My work has me meeting with literally hundreds of coworkers and colleagues each month. I used to jump in a plane each time I had a meeting because that was the accepted way of getting face-to-face time. But I switched to GoToMeeting and I haven't looked back. Not only did it cut my travel time per month in half, but it allowed me to have more interaction with the people that I needed to collaborate with the most. It saved my organization money, it saved me time, and it saved my sanity. I love GoToMeeting. It's so easy to use, and with HD Faces, it really is like meeting in person. So here's what I want you to do. I want you to have the same peace of mind that I have. I want you to try GoToMeeting free for 30 days. For this special offer, visit GoToMeeting.com, click on the Try It Free button, and use the promo code ENTERPRISE. Remember, use the promo code ENTERPRISE. That's GoToMeeting. Meeting is believing. And we thank Citrix for their support of this week in Enterprise Tech. Let's get right back to it. One of the things that we pride ourselves about here on TWiET is that we like to take a nerd's eye view of the topics, of the news, of the stories that are affecting people's lives. So I'm going to bring back a segment that we ran very early in the program that talks specifically about TAPs, what they are, what they can do, and how you use them. This is Stuff My IT Guy Says. Sitting next to Aaron Ingerbretsen from NetOptics, who's going to explain to us a little bit about what it means to get data out of your network. Aaron, thank you very much for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
Now, tell me, how do I get data out of my network and why do I have to?
Reason you're getting data off your network is to analyze that traffic, figure out what people are doing, if there's servers that are acting up and you need to take care of them. Lots of reasons to look at that network traffic. To do that, there's three major ways to get traffic off your network. Okay. Number one is you can put a monitoring device in line.
Right.
Number two, you can pull a span port off of the switch that you're all plugged into. And number three is to install a TAP.
Number one and number three sound similar in that you're putting a device into the network, into the connection between two different devices.
Right.
But we know that's not the same. What is the difference between number one and number three?
So number one is putting that device in line. If that device fails, network traffic stops.
Whereas with a TAP,
right, you install a TAP into your network between those two devices. If anything were ever to happen, a power failure, doesn't matter, network traffic will continue to pass.
And of course, here at Interop, we would always, always, always use method number three because you don't want a single point of failure to take down the entire network.
Exactly.
Okay. Now, that explains why I'd go with number three over number one. But what about number two? Explain this span port. What is that?
All right. So a span port, this is a terminology typically used with Cisco switches.
Okay.
It can also be used as a mirror port, more commonly known if you have an HP environment.
Right.
Which basically means you're taking that traffic going on that switch and you're sending it over to another port. And then that port has all the replicated traffic you then forward to your tool.
What are the distinct advantages and disadvantages of spanning or tapping?
All right. So spanning is very simple to set up.
Few commands, boom.
Few commands and you're done. You know, a tap, plug it in, you're also done. Everyone uses spanning, and spanning is still used even in a TAP environment. There's still valid reasons for it. However, there are a lot of limitations now to span ports, such as a switch is made to switch packets back and forth around the network. It is not made as a monitoring tool. So if you oversubscribe or you start to really use the CPU cycles on that switch, first place it's going to drop packets is to the span port.
Right.
Which is great if you're the network guy, really bad if you're the monitoring guy.
Even though we use both spanning and tapping, we understand that you're going to want taps in place, because if there starts to be a network event, if you are oversubscribing a switch, if you are overloading a particular segment of the network, that's not the time to lose your monitoring.
Right.
Right. Okay.
Right. And one other big reason to go with a tap instead of span is when there are CRC errors or there's errors going on within your packet, layer two switches are made to drop those packets and request that packet again, saying something is wrong with this packet, send me another. Well, if those keep happening and the switch keeps dropping them, how is the monitoring guy ever going to know what's right. going on?
Because of the function of a switch, it can actually disguise some of the network problems that a tap could pick up.
That's right.
Right. Now let's focus on taps because, well, let's NetOptics and taps are almost synonymous. You were involved in taps way, way back. It's in your DNA. Explain to me what the philosophy of taps is for NetOptics.
All right. Well, so the philosophy for taps is not to be a point of failure in your network. Mm-hmm. You know, build these things robust.
Right.
If you even notice on a fiber tap, there is not even a power supply. These things just work. Mm-hmm. It's adding like 6 inches of cable. And what we're doing is we're splitting off a portion of that fiber light, and we're sending out to the monitoring tools.
Right.
Yeah. And I actually even works the same way for the copper, which is it's got power adapters here, mm-hmm. but if you were to pull these off, you could still pass traffic through. It's again, it's designed not to be that single point of failure within your network.
Exactly.
Could you please explain the differences between the different types of taps we've got on the table? We've got this one tap that has four ports. It has AB. We've got a fiber tap that seems to be the same, and then we've got a different type of tap over there. What are the differences between styles of taps?
So let me show you on, say, this is our fiber. This is a 10 gig fiber tap right here. This is what we're using in the show this week. So what you have is you have AB, and that is your network device 1 and your network device 2, and you sit between the two network devices. That traffic on A is replicated out the A port here, and on B, replicate out the B port. So now you have these two ports, which are both transmitting data.
Okay, so you could see one side or the other.
Right.
Now, I could see the usefulness of that, but really, why would you want to do that? Why would you want to split the traffic like that?
Well, a lot of people don't really understand that on a 1 gig link, there's a potential of 2 gig of traffic.
Right. That's in both ways.
Right.
If you were to combine the two and you were to max out each direction, you wouldn't get all the packets.
Right. That whatever you're looking at on that one port would just be dropping packets.
And that same philosophy is continued in this. We've got AB and then we've got AB, so I can watch each direction at line speed.
Right.
Now that tap is slightly different. Explain that.
So this is what we call an aggregating tap.
Okay.
So this is where we take the traffic from network device A and network device B. We replicated out one port. So by doing this, this is great for a field application.
That's right. I was just thinking that. Yeah.
Right? You want to look at the traffic, you tap it, and your laptop only has one NIC on it. So now you're going to see both sides of traffic on one NIC.
Different taps for different needs.
That's right.
All right. Now, we are going to be doing a further review of these taps. NetOptics was nice enough to send a few to our lab. And we're going to show our audience exactly what kind of data they can pull off using tools like Wireshark. I'm Father Robert Ballasaire, and you've just been learned. So when we talk about taps, it really needs to go no further than the description that we just gave you. They're devices that go in line that allow you to pass traffic through, but can siphon off the data, can get exact copies of all the data that passes through the device. It doesn't matter what kind of tap you're using. You might be using a copper tap. You might be using a fiber tap. You might be using an aggregating tap. The technology is the same, and we showed you in last week's episode, if you want to go back, exactly what kind of data you could capture off of that. But what I want to explain now is something that Steve Gibson started explaining on Security Now last week, and that is, well, the prism effect. We're going to show you in the video, for those audio listeners, we've got a piece of fiber shining a laser through it. If you bend the fiber enough, you can actually see in this video how the light starts to show through the cladding. That's essentially all that you're doing inside of a tap. You're bending the fiber enough so that some of the light starts to come out. And the more you bend it, the more light comes out. It continues along the way, but you're now splitting the strength of the light signal so that you can take some of it and siphon it off to your capture device, whatever it might be. Chibert, I know that you've played a lot with fiber. It really is that simple, right? You bend the fiber and you get light out of the side.
Yeah, for certain types of taps. Some taps actually go through, they actually go and scrape away part of the cladding and bond the tap fiber to it. And that allows you to get more light out of it. But yeah, literally, especially on things like multi-mode fiber, you could actually just bend the fiber, put it in a jig, bend it, and you can actually pull the data off it. This is why right. In high security installations, there's actually specialized equipment that will actually monitor a waveform to see if it changes.
Right, right. Now, there are some people in the chat room who are referring to beam splitters, who are referring to different ways of dividing optical energy. But some of the highest-end boxes, and I'm talking, I think I can mention them, Gigamon, NetOptics, if you open them up, it really is just fiber. There's no complicated optics in there. They just have a really good way of scraping away the cladding and getting just enough light out to allow the signal to continue to propagate while getting their tap. I bring this up because there seems to be a fight both in our chat room and on the web of exactly what you would have to do in order to be able to tap a line. Some people are saying you have to install millions of dollars worth of equipment. It really isn't that complicated. Curtis, let me go over to you. On the enterprise side, we talked about this last week. We all just assume that everything that runs through a network is going to be tapped, right? Everything is going to be monitored. We know this. When I walk into my office network, I just assume that any packet is going to be recorded somewhere, maybe monitored, maybe turned into data that my IT manager can use.
Well, certainly if anything is going over the internet, that's the assumption, and that's why companies, especially those in regulated industries, invest so heavily in encryption technology. They want to make it so that when the inevitable interception occurs, that the data that is collected is meaningless to the individual or organization collecting it. The only way around that, really, is a dedicated private network. And in the companies where you see those, you also see some very high security endpoints and transit mechanisms. So for most individuals, for most companies, for most instances, the assumption is that someone somewhere
is listening to your data. Oliver, let me go over to you. You've been a little quiet on this side. What do you think is the perception of this tapping process? Do Americans understand what's going on when they say that the NSA has been tapping your data stream?
Probably not. I mean, they're going to base it on the concept of a phone tap, right? Which means they're listening to everything, they understand everything, and fancy analysis is not required, right? It's basically evidence as soon as it comes off, which obviously isn't true. They have to do a lot of big data analysis. But I was wondering, are you saying the government would have a problem installing these taps?
Not really, not at all, actually. They have access to all the physical lines. I'm saying tapping it's really trivial. There's not much that's involved in tapping a fiber optic line.
No, and I mean, they wouldn't really need to tap to put down their own taps, right? They have the right to request that information from whoever they want, and they have the right to do it legally, so... Right. For them, it's really just a matter of analyzing the data.
Well, see, this is interesting. And again, listen to Security Now last week if you want to hear Steve Gibson's analysis. It is actually excellent analysis. His take on it was the name of the program, PRISM, kind of gives away the fact that the government they're just tapping the lines. They wouldn't actually have to go and install equipment in the back rooms of Google and Microsoft and Facebook and Apple, etc. They just need to tap the line. They just need to get onto the backbone, go to AT&T, find the interconnects between these companies, and effectively that gives them access to all the same data. I mean, they don't have direct access into the server, but they actually do have copies of every single bit of data that passes over the network. Now, let's go on to a related topic here. In the chat room, CR1 wants to know, well, once we've tapped this, once we've actually got copies of the data stream, what do we do with that data? If Jammer B will run that second demonstration video, we've actually got a demo here of Wireshark, which is a free, very easily available program that you can run on your computer right now, which will allow you, in conjunction with a tap, to capture pretty much every bit of data that's going over the network and put it into terms that even the layperson can understand. What you see in this screen right now for our audio listeners is we've got a computer on the left that's running a web page. This computer on the right is running Wireshark. And the status screen is actually the individual packets. Now, the amazing thing is that within this screen, you see the source. You see the destination. So where it's coming from, where it's going to. You even get to see what kind of traffic it is, and you can actually decode it. You can use this to decode in real time a voice over IP call, or you could watch someone's web stream. You could watch video that's being transferred over a network simply by running the captured traffic through Wireshark. Chibert, I know that you've played a lot with Wireshark with tapping software. How difficult is this to do?
Not hard at all. Wireshark does take a little bit of learning, but it's not horrible. Now, what I should point out is Wireshark is actually a very simplistic protocol analyzer. There are hundreds, maybe even thousands of products out there that allow you to correlate data feeds from lots and lots and lots of places. In fact, the NetScout guys are working with me on installing an InfiniStream into the University of Hawaii School of Ocean Earth Science and Technology network. Because what we want to be able to do is track down problems that are transient. So we're actually going to be tapping our main feeds using a Gigamon box and correlate what's going on between a lot of different switches. Because we've got a transient problem where we're getting connections being dropped on large FTP transfers. And unfortunately, the data off the switches is not giving us an answer. And some of the vendors of the switches are sitting there scratching their heads. So we're going to actually take it up a notch and correlate across multiple switches and multiple feeds.
Right, right. Now, Curtis, I want to throw this over to you because there is one more element that we've spoken about previously on Twyatt that I think needs to be brought up. And that is this tapping works because of peering, because of the way the internet works. Now, really quickly, for the folks playing at home, can you explain exactly what peering is?
Well, peering is the concept, really, it's the basic concept behind the internet, the notion that we have separate networks that are brought together and that all of these have a relationship, a defined relationship that can vary between one and the other of the networks. I mean, you can have transit relationships where there's a business relationship between the networks that says, I will carry your traffic and you will pay me a little bit for every bit that's carried. You can have true peers where basically they agree that transit is going to happen, but because the volumes of traffic are roughly the same, they will do a trade agreement or a customer, which is pretty much what it says. And the nice thing is that with each of these, you have routing relationships that define how the traffic is going to be prioritized, how it's going to be routed between nodes in the network. The ultimate goal, though, is that when you have a customer on one edge of one network, another customer on an edge of another network, that the two customers can send traffic back and forth without ever having to really know how it gets from place to place.
Yeah, yeah. But of course, the most important item here is that peering is what allows a tap to be effective in getting data from all these different providers. There is a common misconception that I did not realize this until I started jumping into forums. some people think that when I connect to a server in New York, that somehow there's a direct line between me and the server in New York. We know if we're network administrators, we know that that's not the case. I'm actually jumping through several, maybe dozens of different networks in order to get to that server and for that server to get back to me, all the while being routed via BGP in order to get the data to where it needs to go. If I get a tap somewhere in the backbone, it allows me to basically sniff data from multiple servers, multiple providers, multiple ISPs. I'm sorry, you were saying?
No, that's entirely true. Now, what it may not do, and this is important as well, is let you sniff every packet of a particular conversation, because, you know, what you've been talking about, obviously, is packet switching versus circuit switching. The I have a direct line from point A to point B is the old telephone model, where in the original Bell system, that's exactly what happened. A copper connection was established from one telephone to another. And very early networking used the same model. What packet switching did was break that up and say that for every individual packet of network information, a separate, very brief, almost ephemeral circuit would be established. And no two packets may have the same transited path. So it's very easy, as you said, if you put a tap on one of the backbones, to get individual packets and its related metadata, that's important, from billions upon billions of conversations. What you may not get is the total conversation of any one of those.
There's a good question from Cake Interface in the chat room about, does SSL protect us from sniffing? It provides rudimentary protection, but you can still get metadata because the routers still need to be able to understand the basic TCP IP protocol. They need to know the destination address and the source address. So I can still capture that even if I can't read the content. Now, let me go over to you, Oliver. One of the stories that we covered last week was about how the NSA was creating a brand spanking new data, or how they created a brand spanking new data center in Utah. It's a $2 billion facility. It's got 1 million square feet. It makes sense that it's filled to the brim with storage and servers. When we start talking about all the data that could be pulled off of the various taps around the backbone of the internet in the United States, it seems logical that the NSA would need a facility like that, yes?
If they're analyzing all those streams, hell yeah. In fact, I would think they need multiple versions of that, and we probably only know about the one.
Oh, careful. I don't want to get too tinfoil hatty. But that actually is a large part of the discussion, which is, well, if this is the information we know, what don't we know? I want to pull away from this. We are actually going to be talking about the practical implications of the NSA spying program on the enterprise, on tech in the enterprise, how we should be running our privacy, our security policies. But before that, I do want to take some time to talk about our second sponsor, and that is Hover. Now, are you looking for a reliable, honest, and yes, honesty is a big thing these days, domain name registrar and management service that is easy to use? If so, well, then you got to check out Hover. Hover makes it easy. They believe that everyone should be able to take control of their online identity with their own domain name, and they make it easy for you to do so. Hover takes all the hassle out of owning and managing domain names with smart, easy-to-use, friction-free, and powerful domain name management tools. Hover is all about honesty. You see, they don't believe in heavy-handed upselling or aggressive cross-selling. They don't believe in hiding functionality or requiring extra payment for things that should be free, should be included with your domain name management. Things like Whois privacy, subdomains, and URL forwarding. Hover keeps it real. They only offer services that enhance the domain name experience. They only partner with companies that they believe will offer their customers the values and the good things that Hover is known to provide on its own. Hover email makes it easy and affordable to create a memorable email address and eschew the impersonal free email web addresses. They also offer you choice, and boy, do we love choice. They give you 23 TLDs, top-level domains like the popular .com, .net, .org, as well as .tv, .pro, .movi, and .biz. They also offer the most country codes, TLDs like .ca, .asia, .us, and .uk. and many .com addresses are no longer available these days. That's why Hover offers a huge selection of .net addresses, as many as you want. There are a lot of unusual .whatever addresses that you can also choose, but .net is really the alternative to turn to, and Hover recognizes that. Now, Hover is here for the long haul, which is important anytime we talk about a domain name registrar, because you don't want a fly-by-night outfit. They offer excellent online help, support documentation and tutorials, covering everything from domain names to setting up redirects and domain forwards to pointing DNS to the most popular web hosting services and much, much more. Hover offers no hold, no wait, and no transfer phone support. Call 1-866-731-6556 Monday to Friday, 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, and you'll be speaking to a live person who is empowered and eager to help. Hover is also a part of Two Cows. For us old geeks, that's actually huge street cred. It's a company that's been around since 1994 and that is one of the largest domain name registrars in the world. So here's what we want you to do. We want you to visit Hover today at hover.com/enterprise and see if they might offer a solution that's for you. To register your domain name, use our offer code ENTERPRISE and get 10% off. That's hover.com/enterprise. And we thank Hover for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Now let's get right back to it. What does all of this mean for the enterprise? Now, there's going to be a lot of fallout. We're still shaking out exactly what's happened. We're trying to figure out what's going on with the spying program. But, well, with Google and others insisting that they haven't granted backdoor access to their servers, my question to the panel is, if trust is the currency on which tech companies build their business, have they just lost all their currency? Let's start with you, Cheever.
Sorry, I was actually paying attention to the chat room, so I'm going to need that question one more time.
Well, if trust is the currency on which tech companies build their businesses, have they lost all their currency? If we don't trust them, if we don't think that their web services are going to be as secure as their EULA says, who's going to use them?
You know, that's I'm going to actually answer that with another question. You know, how much do you trust your telephone company? How much do you trust your cellular carrier? All of them have agreements with the federal government for tapping under certain conditions. So if your ISP is tapping under certain conditions and providing the government with the ability to go and dive deep, do more than just metadata, does that break the trust? I don't know. A lot of the people that I've been talking to don't seem to mind it that much as long as there's no abuses. Now, the big question is, how do we judge abuses? Who watches the watchers? And that's why I'm hoping our friends in Congress are actually paying attention to this issue.
All right. Oliver, let me throw over to you. Trust is an ephemeral thing. Once you lose it, it's really, really difficult to reestablish. Sometimes it's impossible. Do you think it will change how we use web services, cloud services, if now we're wondering whether or not that service is turning our data directly over to the government?
Yeah, I'm expecting to see a big dip in corporate cloud use, right? I mean, Office 365, even cloud services, let alone cloud computing. I expect a lot of conservative businesses to just say, hey, I'm gonna back behind my firewall now. I'm going to hire more security guys. I'm going to beef up my firewall systems, and I'm going to keep my data private as much as I can. Out in the cloud, I mean, ever since cloud started, there have been worries about security in the cloud. Now with this out there, I'm expecting at least in the short term to see a serious dip in enterprise cloud computing initiatives.
Oh, I love this. Great. Good. This is where the discussion is going to lie. Curtis, let me throw over to you. Back in episode 20 of Twiet, we started talking about the privacy concerns, how the privacy concerns in the cloud could kill a multi-trillion dollar industry in its infancy. What do you think about what Oliver just said? Is this going to curb cloud services? If I can't trust that my documents are as secure in the cloud as they are on my hard drive or on my network, naturally, as an enterprise, I'm not going to want to store it in the cloud, right?
Well, the place where I see this having a real impact is on international cloud adoption. Within the U.S., if you go to a company and say, you know what, if the Justice Department tells a provider that they have a court order to look at your stuff and your provider is going to have to acknowledge, cope with the court order, the Enterprise is not going to be surprised. I mean, the Enterprise itself would have to respond to a court order. That's part of the justice system in the U.S. Where it gets interesting is international cases. Companies located overseas have different relationships with the courts and different expectations of privacy than U.S. companies have. And so what I see here is a segregation of data on national boundaries. We're going to see, to some extent, some limits on the internationalization of the cloud. And I think that could very well end up slowing things down just a bit.
I like that. Cheever, talk to me about that internationalization of the cloud. Because, again, another angle to this story is the fact that some of what the NSA is doing seems to fit quite well within what they were empowered to do by law. But what about international companies, international enterprises that are doing business in the United States? Their data is passing through our network. They're not necessarily subject to all the same laws. This seems to be just an angle that the law is woefully equipped to handle.
I don't know. You know, the Europeans have known that the U.S. taps any communications between America and their trading partners or business partners. And, you know, don't think the Europeans aren't doing this. The Europeans are just as good at tapping lines as the United States is. And especially when we start getting into Asia, you know, our friends in China, their equipment, a lot of their equipment from Chinese manufacturers have been proven to phone home. So, yeah, it's part of doing business. Yeah, if you have data that is sensitive to you, for God's sakes, encrypt it. At least make the NSA work hard to get at it. But, yeah, this is part of doing business now.
Okay. Let me back up a little bit again. And so we've got the NSA essentially saying that their spying has broken up at least, you know, 20 countries worth of plots against us. They claim that they've captured less than 400 phone numbers that were checked against the database of U.S. phone records, and that these checks have helped them to stop a 2009 Al-Qaeda plot to blow up a U.S. subway. Now, this is all in the realm of public opinion. You can believe it or you cannot believe it. But I think what the four of us are trying to get to is the idea that we now have to look at how this is going to change the way that we do business, how we are going to set up our networks. My question to you first, Oliver, is this. For the longest time, we have had the technology to encrypt our data. We've had the technology to encrypt our emails, to encrypt our files, to really put into effect the trust no one policy, make sure that it is as secure as possible. Why is it that you think that so few of us have actually done that? This bites us each and every time. This was even before the NSA spy ring was exposed. When we were talking about cloud services, there was always this threat that the United States government would come in and confiscate a server or confiscate a hard drive. That would all go away if we were all encrypted, right?
You're talking at an enterprise level or an individual level?
Both.
Enterprise level, I'm not at the enterprise, at the big business level, I'm pretty sure they do whatever they're required to do based on compliance laws, right? And if that includes encrypting data, which I believe it does for at least part of HIPAA, they'll do it, right? Medium-sized or small businesses, yeah, I'm sure those guys skate. And partially because, A, they either think or it does actually add cost to their IT management, and they don't really understand what's needed, right? This is another mystical topic that they're not it's an added learning curve. And that's, I think, the same reason that individuals don't do it, right? I don't want to deal with encrypting my email. I just want to press send. Right. And the scary thing now is with this lone wolf provision of the FISA Act. Right. I'm sure it's a very small percentage of the population that does actively encrypt its email. So I guess if you start doing it, now you're going to wonder if you're being flagged.
I like that. Curtis, let me go over to you from the enterprise side. How is encryption looked at in terms of compliance, in terms of best practices? Is it really a concern in enterprises, at least the enterprises that you've dealt with? Oh, you're muted.
Thank you. There's a shift that's going on as I talk to companies. 10 years ago, encryption was something that happened on a case-by-case basis. But now there's a great realization that one very realistic security posture is, as I've talked about, the assumption that anything you send over the internet will be intercepted and that hackers will get through your perimeter defense. And so you're seeing a growing number of companies who are taking the position that everything needs to be encrypted. Data at rest, data in motion, on a whole server, whole disk, whole database point of view. That also provides, I think, some better legal protection, because all of a sudden it's not a question of, well, gee, why did you encrypt this file? Was there something in it that you thought would be encrypted? Now companies are saying, no, our policy is simply to encrypt everything. And that way we don't discriminate between types of data, particular files. We simply encrypt everything. It's in some senses another aspect of the data retention policies, you know, to say all email will be deleted after X number of days. We'll go back. We will not keep copies of archived email files beyond a certain number of days. As it turns out, it's very convenient for e-discovery. And if it's part of the overall corporate policy, it's not something that's liable to fall under particular legal scrutiny.
Right. Chiebert, I want to shift this up a little bit. There has been a lot of disdain throughout the United States among some of the technorati that so many Americans seem to be okay with this. We really don't care. I mean, fine. Yeah, look at my tweets. Look at my email. It doesn't matter to me. It seems to be the purveying feeling that, yeah, it's kind of creepy that the NSA is spying on me, but it's not one of my top concerns. Now, on the other side, you've got the people who are always quoting Benjamin Franklin and saying those who are willing to give up some of their privacy in order for some security deserve neither. Is there a mid-ground, or have we seen really a mindset shift? Is there a difference in this generation, especially the millennial generation, that is so used to being social, that is so used to oversharing, that what the NSA is doing doesn't seem like anything new?
My problem with a lot of the social generation is they keep forgetting how much is shared. You know, regardless of people tapping, you know, people keep throwing too much stuff onto Facebook. I keep telling my students to shut up. Anyway, getting on to the fact that, you know, everybody's used to everybody listening. So maybe the world is changing. I'm really not sure, but I will say the general public, if it gets slapped in the face with "I'm listening to you," you know, they have a problem with that. But as long as it doesn't bother them, as long as it's not abused, a lot of people don't seem to care anymore. You know, is that a change? Yeah, probably. Is it a change for the good? I'm not sure yet. I'd kind of like to think that, you know, if I have a private email with my wife when I'm on travel, that it stays relatively private. You know, I'd like to, you know, have people not know that maybe that latest proctologist exam showed up something nasty. And I'd like to break that to my friends privately. But for the most part, I really don't care that much anymore.
Oliver, what do you think? Do people just not care? Is this a big story for a previous generation, but a non-story for the current generation? Oh, you're muted.
Man, we're all forgetting that. Sorry. Yes, I do think most people don't care. I definitely do not think that's a good idea. And the reason I don't think it's a good idea is I have these arguments with my father, and he's, you know, the old school, says, hey, if they're looking for terrorists, you should just let them do whatever they want. And my point back is, great, today it's terrorists, right? But when you say the term bad guys, it's a pretty vague term, so they can pretty much redefine that term any way they want sooner or later. So this could be turned to all kinds of crimes. It could be turned to all kinds of different sorts of people. It could be an ethnic thing. It could be various. I mean, I can't even think of all the different ways. Right. By the time it gets turned that way, it's too late to stop. Right. If you're going to fight it, we got to fight it now. And that's a legislative issue, right? We have to get a little more political.
Ooh, okay. Well, we're going to be right back to talk about whether or not this is a legislative issue. But before that, I want to take time to talk about our last sponsor, the last sponsor of the Twiat Riot. And of course, that's TechServe. We talk a lot about enterprise tech, but not a whole lot about Apple tech. And that's just wrong because we know Apple is a big part of the enterprise. With BYOD, with the changing environment in today's IT infrastructure, Apple needs to be part of the discussion. That's why I'm really happy to have TechServe on board as a supporter of the Twiat Riot. Now, as New York's premier authorized Apple reseller and technology provider, TechServe serves creative professionals at all levels, from individual customers to Fortune 100 companies. TechServe carries a full range of Apple products, from iPhones and iPads to iMacs, MacBooks, iPods, and accessories. TechServe also has a range of partnerships with top vendors who facilitate flexible, efficient, and creative solutions for all of your business needs. TechServe assists businesses of all sizes to deploy Apple, Avid, and Adobe solutions throughout the United States. Whether you're already committed to iPads or just getting started, from sales to support, process to practice, TechServe can help. Now, some amazing technology solutions are being deployed on iPads right now. If you've been to the Delta terminals in LaGuardia, Toronto, or Minneapolis, you may have noticed that nearly every seat in the terminal is equipped with an iPad. Travelers can now sit anywhere in the terminal and receive real-time flight updates on their iPad or use them to order food, play games, browse the internet, and check email while they're waiting. Over 1.5 million visitors used these iPads in Delta's terminals just this past year. The result has been a double-digit increase in food and beverage revenue and the highest customer satisfaction scores of all participating airports. OTG Management is the hospitality company behind Delta's terminals. They've turned to TechServe to provide, configure, and install the world's largest deployment of iPads, a number that just keeps growing as they add new terminals. And TechServe really was the natural place for them to turn because they sell, support, personalize, configure, and manage massive iPad projects. It's what they do. From the Delta terminals to a school with 700 chef instructors to an operation that delivered personally configured iPads to 3,000 cable technicians. TechServe is able to do full lifecycle management for all of your technology needs by providing the devices that you need, getting them up and running, teaching you and your staff how to effectively use them, and maintaining them so that they're working efficiently. TechServe also provides ongoing support so that if your enterprise has a problem, help is never farther than a phone call away. If you're considering adding iPads to your business, why not ensure the project's success with the world's most experienced partner? Now, if your business is considering integrating iOS technology at your workplace, then contact TechServe today and receive a complimentary iPad deployment assessment. Visit techserve.com/Twiat, and TechServe will help you assess your current or future iPad needs and give you advice to make it a success. That's techserve.com/Twiat, techserve.com/Twiat. And we thank TechServe for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Now, let's close it out with the bombshell that Oliver just dropped on us. Is this a legislative solution? Cheebert. It seems to me that there's a really, really good parallel between what's going on now and what we saw in the recording industry, the RIAA and the MPAA, where some people are crying for a legislative solution, whereas you have technorati who are saying this goes beyond legislation. This technology is now too easy for you to say that this is acceptable and this is not. Do you see this being a legislative solution, or is this something that needs to go beyond that? Does this have to be a cultural change? Does this have to be a technological change? Or does this have to be, as I have often said, the responsibility of the individual person and business to make sure they are responsible for their own data security and data integrity?
You know, the question really is, can people behave without rules? We've seen it over the millennia that most people, if they don't have rules to fall back on, will tend to misbehave. So, you know, just look at the Ten Commandments. So maybe what we need is we need a set of rules that people can say, hey, this is what the expected is of a citizen, and the expectation is blah. So, maybe we do need some legislation to lay down what is expected of a citizen in this day and age.
I like that. Curtis, we've got Beatmaster in the chat room who is saying, the moment law enforcement of any kind has to break laws to enforce laws, especially in a preventative use case, they lose their integrity and reason of being. What do you think about this? Is this a legislative solution? Is this an attitudinal solution? Is this a technology solution? What are we looking at here?
Well, I think ultimately it has to be a legislative solution because the legislative branch is what granted the power to these agencies to do what they're doing. The real problem that we're seeing here is one, and Chiebert mentioned this word, expectation. People were going along with one set of expectations, and all of a sudden, they've been told that what was happening was something else. Now, people told their legislators in the clearest possible language that they really, truly did not want to have to worry about being blown up in their own cities. The legislators responded pretty reasonably by saying, great, we want to be reelected, so we will do what we must to prevent that. And they granted the power to the people who are charged with making that happen, the NSA and the rest of our security and surveillance apparatus. Now that the debate has come about, you know, what we're dealing with, what's actually required to protect us, people are saying, well, maybe it's too much. It's a debate that needs to happen. It's a debate that must include the legislative branch, and I think it's one where the answer is probably somewhere other than where we are right now. The real damage behind all this, though, is the fact that we've seen a lot of people say that their basic faith in government, their trust in the government institutions has been damaged, and that has a whole series of consequences that go well beyond the basic debate about whether someone is listening to your phone calls or reading your emails.
That's actually a great point, Curtis, that the fact that we've lost our faith in our legislators. We've lost our faith that they're doing what they're supposed to be doing to protect the Constitution, which lets me go over to Oliver. Oliver, listening to all of that, listening to this idea of what kind of legislative solutions could be put into place, whether or not we have the trust that we need from our people, of our legislators, of our government, what are we looking at in terms of the near-term solutions? Because sussing this out is going to take a long, long time. There's going to be a lot of dishonesty. There's going to be a lot of hearsay. There's going to be a lot of conspiracy theories. But if you were running an enterprise today, what would be the things that you would concretely do to take responsibility for your privacy and then maybe to push for legislative solutions?
Sadly, my immediate... I would like to say that I would triple my security immediately, but I think it would depend on what kind of business I was in. But if I was in a business where I had data I really thought I needed to protect, I would be a turtle in my shell right now. Everything gets pulled in. Everything gets hidden under armor until I see something being changed. It's just too scary, right? I mean, I've lost my trust in my government mainly because I'm not sure what they're going to do next. I see a lot of stuff in the chat room here on Brian's comment about rules, right? Okay, but I think we have all the rules. The rules are there. It's just they're so complex, we can't understand them. So you don't really know what's going to get dumped on you. So, yeah, I would – as far as the solution goes, you're asking the wrong guy. I don't see one in the near future, right? The solution would be the American public getting together and making a political issue out of this. And frankly, I haven't seen that in, you know, a few decades. I'm not sure if that's actually going to happen.
Yeah. Curtis, let's go over to you. Are you going to turtle? I mean, is that your advice to businesses that in this day and age, until we've figured this out, that they need to be as paranoid as possible? They need to pull it back within the firewall. They need to get it onto their own servers, onto their own networks, get any sensitive data out of the cloud, out of places where it could possibly be that easily copied and, well, essentially spied upon by the government.
No, these days, especially for smaller companies, that's an awfully expensive way of turning. I think that the right answer is to encrypt everything, both at rest and in motion, and take reasonable precautions and understand that your data is going to be sniffed, your firewalls will be breached, whether by those who have a court order behind them or not. Therefore, the only reasonable posture is to make sure that when the data is intercepted, it is of as little value to the people intercepting as possible. Encrypt, encrypt, encrypt.
Actually, I love that. I love that we're all sort of going in the same side. We've all seen how easy it is to tap something. It is incredibly easy to get a hold of the data stream. And so we're all kind of retreating into our shells. Chibert, what about you? What kind of advice would you offer? That same scenario. We know that it's going to be a while before we get any sort of legislative solution. And even if we do, it's probably not going to make sense immediately. What would you suggest for the small business, for the enterprise, for the campus, like, for example, the University of Hawaii, where you reside? What kind of measures should be taken to protect data security?
Actually, I'm going to shy away from a technological solution. You know, encryption is good. I encrypt a lot of things already. However, the complacency of the U.S. general public, or actually the complacency even of what I've seen traveling throughout Europe and so forth, is that everybody seems to hate their government, but they're not willing to step up. I've personally sponsored two bills in my state legislature, and it's not hard to do. In fact, if you go and talk to your representative, they are dying for citizens to come up and help them introduce bills. You know, that's why some of the bills that they introduce are crap, because they're working in a vacuum, because the general public just doesn't talk to them. Show up to the hearings, testify, for God's sakes. Hawaii, most of the states actually have an app now for the iPhone or iOS or Android, where it actually has contact information, contact methods, and even guidance on how to sponsor a bill. For God's sakes, get involved, because if the government sucks, it's because you voted them in. Get off your ass, get involved with government.
You know, I think we're going to leave it on that. We've got a very nice diversity of opinions here. Everything from the technological solution to the attitudinal solution to the legislative solution. And I think that's really where we have to be. This is a complex problem that involves many different things. It's not just technology. It's not just our willingness to be monitored. It's not just our desire to be safe. It has to do with how we consider ourselves a society and the rules within that society. I think we're in a good spot. I want to thank our panelists for sticking around for the best dang podcast in the universe. That's right. I actually called the NSA. They've been monitoring. We really are. And let's give you a little bit of shout out time, starting with you, Chibert. Chibert, what's going on? What do you think the Twilight Riot should know about the Geek in Paradise?
Well, the Geek in Paradise is probably going to be changing the Twitter handle on the bottom third. Probably the next time we go live again. And we're going to start actually ramping up things for Thin Links, because I am going to be shipping out the review units hopefully next week.
Ooh, we love review units. What about you, Curtis? What's going on the East Coast, or I forget where you are again, on the road with your Wi-Fi connection?
Well, I'm in Boston at the E2 conference this week. If anybody's here, I would love to meet them. If not, please follow my live coverage of this conference all about collaboration and social media over at Enterprise Efficiency. I'm going to be hammering away at the keys for the next couple of days. After that, I get to stay in the swamp for a while, and boy, I'm looking forward to that.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Oliver, it's always a pleasure to have you on the program. Tell the Twilight Riot what you're up to, and if you have any exciting projects coming up.
Actually, I finally do. So I have two. One, I'm moving back east. That's a major thing for me, and you guys don't care. But the second thing is I'm working actually with Brian to do a private cloud head-to-head if we can manage it, right? And that would be what Brian was said sometime in the winter, fall/winter. I'm looking forward to the test, and B, I get to do it in Honolulu on someone else's dime. So that's very psychable.
We love it. Thank you all to the panelists. You guys are you superstars. I mean, we wouldn't have this kind of a discussion if it weren't for the fact that you're so well-versed in technology and legislation and pretty much everything else that a geek would like. I also want to thank you. That's right. The person watching this right now, the person listening to this, for listening It's Wyatt. We wouldn't do this show if we didn't have your support. And I'm just absolutely blown away by the amount of support that we've gotten over this past year. Now, we want to do something special for you. We want to give you each and every single episode of Twiet automatically. That's right. Every week, delivered to the device of your choice. If right now you go to twit.tv/Twiet, you'll be able to find all the different ways that you can have every episode automatically delivered into your iPhone, your iPad, your iPod, your Android phone or tablet, your device of choice. We make it easy because we want you to get all the Twiet goodness that you want. Also, did you know that we have a YouTube page? That's right. If you go to youtube.com/Twiet, not only will you be able to find all of our episodes, but we're starting to put up special content. That's right. All the little pre-recorded segments, stuff my IT guy says, the pro gear, pro tip, the data closet, things that, just strike my fancy will end up there. So please go and subscribe. Also, you can follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/PadreSJ. Once you follow me, you'll be able to find out what we're doing every week, and you'll also be able to find out what the Digital Jesuit does in his time off. Spoiler, mostly sitting around eating candy. Also, did you know that we do this show live? That's right. Every Monday at noon Pacific time, we get on at live.twit.tv, and we bring you the best dang enterprise podcast we can. And if you're watching it live, why not drop into our live chat room? That's irc.twit.tv, where you'll be able to partake in the experiment that is twit.tv, filled with some of the most brilliant engineers, some of the funniest chat realmers, and yes, some of the most entertaining trolls. Finally, thanks to CyberDog in the chat room, to everyone back at the Brick House who makes this possible, Karsten Bondi, my super producer, John Stalanina, my TD, who is standing in for Jason Howell today, who is away with the flu, and of course, to you. I'm Father Robert Ballester, reminding you that if you want to know what's going on in the Enterprise, just keep Twiet.